Thank you, Jenny, for that wonderful introduction. Hey, no, it's pretty good for memory. Both of the speakers that I was supposed to present with today apologize profusely for not being able to be here. I don't have their presentations, unfortunately, or else I would kind of try to struggle through them for you. But I do loosely know what they were about and the analyses on some of them. I'm kind of more of an analyses person than anything else. So I don't know who kind of came here to talk about those topics, but I can kind of give you a brief rundown, maybe, on what they found and where to maybe find more information. Kind of like very informal, but just to give you an idea, because I know people came here and woke up at 8:30, you know, to come see it. So thank you for that. The first panel of which Michael, or the first session which Michael Reese was going to talk about, was on penile dimensions. We have a host of different data sets where we assess penile dimensions. The particular data set I believe he was going to focus on was from a condom fit and feel study. And within this condom fit and feel study, what we did is sent men a paper measure to measure their penile dimensions. Now, while this has been done before, this study was unique because the dimensions that the participants sent in, based upon on their the width of their penis and also the length of their penis, was going to be used to send them an appropriately sized condom. So the men in this study had a motivation to send in the appropriate size, as to other studies where perhaps, you know, there's the perception that perhaps larger is better, so men may be more likely to maybe inflate their size. So we felt that this was perhaps a more accurate way of assessing penile dimensions because the men in this study had motivation to do that. And we found that those measures did actually more closely represent experimenter measures. So when the experimenter actually went in and measured a man's flaccid penis but pulled, which it tends to be the best measurement, as opposed to self-measurements. So self-measurements were much higher than the measurements that we got on this study. I believe the average was somewhere around 6 inches, if everyone came here just to kind of find out what the average was. There you go, I don't want to disappoint. In terms of the relationship to various types of behaviors, the penile dimensions, so both length, width, and circumference, was not a good predictor of sexual behaviors. It predicted one or two kind of obscure behaviors, not in a really consistent pattern, but there were there was a very wide range of behaviors that we assessed. So obviously, if you conduct enough analyses, by chance, maybe one or two will be significant, so that's kind of what it felt like when we ran those analyses. But for the most part, the take-home message there was that penis size wasn't predicting behavior. So, you know, there's this perception that perhaps men with larger penises are being more sexually promiscuous or have more sexual partners or more frequent sexual partners, and none of that actually came out of the data. Men also weren't more likely to seek testing if they, based upon their objective penis size. Some of this contradicts research in the past, which we found that where penis size has predicted behaviors. And the reason for the discrepancy between our findings and those findings is a lot of those findings are subjective measurements of penile dimensions. So it's how big they think their penis is, which may be more related to perceptions around satisfaction than actual penile dimensions. So when we look at it objectively as a measurement, both the circumference, the length, and the width, we found that that was not a good predictor of behavior. However, there was, in addition to that, I believe it was a single item that assessed satisfaction of penis size. When looking at that single item of satisfaction, now that was a predictor. That was a predictor of increasingly sexually healthy behaviors.
Wait, so the greater size was correlated, or
greater satisfaction.
Greater.
So people who are more satisfied with their genitals, and we've seen this in other things as well, you know, I feel okay about my genitals, so I'm okay with showing them to that healthcare provider. I feel okay about my genitals, so I'm going to be okay with talking, you know, or engaging in behaviors with my partner. So it's more a function of satisfaction with genitalia than any really objective measurement around penile dimensions. So that's it in a nutshell. I'm happy to, I don't know, take quick questions. I can try to answer whatever there
so,
is.
So those of you who just come in a little late, Vanessa just tried to give a nutshell of Michael Reese's presentation since he can't be here today. So yeah, so maybe some quick questions on penile dimension.
Yeah.
Assuming this is a heterosexual sample?
Primarily. We do have in the works in the future looking at genital perceptions with a sample of men who have sex with men and kind of understanding body perceptions better in that sample. There definitely was a subset. I don't remember right now looking at separately how they compared. Erect. Good question. Thank you for clarification. I'm sorry. Oh no, of course. So when they, and I can give a little more detail about the kit. So yeah, they were asked to measure themselves at, you know, when they were fully erect. So he asked whether the men were erect or flaccid at the time of the measurement, and I said that they were asked to be erect. Another finding that we had that I did not just mention is the type of behavior that the men engaged in order to achieve that erection predicted the size of the length and width of the penis, or the overall circumference. So men who were just using their own hand in order to, manually stimulating themselves, had significantly smaller penile dimensions than men who use several methods, including those with partnered methods, in order to achieve that erection. Yeah. So it was overall satisfaction with their penis size. Oh, so was so are you asking whether satisfaction was correlated with penis size?
Right, did it go up like this, or was it, you know?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, and I wish that I had a good answer. I believe that the two are correlated. It was far from a perfect correlation. I would be more than happy to look at that for you in the data. Like I said, this isn't my presentation. So men with larger penises would be more likely to also be more satisfied? Oh yeah. So men from both. So even at so there's like the ideal area of length. Yeah. Yeah. No, and I think that there is some research, or at least kind of anecdotal evidence, that there are men who are also extremely large who are also unsatisfied. So it can kind of go both ways. Yeah.
When you say satisfied, if the respondents say, "I'm satisfied with it," is that what they're saying? Or are they saying it's too big, it's too small, it's crooked, it's what?
And I'm going to talk a little bit about that more in my talk. Not about penises, obviously. Given the name of my talk, that would be unusual. However, I'm going to talk about how important it is to be really specific in your measurements, because I think part of the problem with genital research, which is you know, almost non-existent. But what's out there, oftentimes we use these really global measurements, so we don't actually know what we're asking. We don't know what we're getting. So I think that your question is a very good one, and I think this speaks to yours as well. You know, the idea of, like, we have this perception that maybe bigger is better and bigger is more satisfied, or when we ask somebody whether they're satisfied with their penis size, we're making assumptions about what that means, where I think that really needs to be unpacked a lot more. And that's really what my presentation is going to be about, however, with the vulva.
Any other questions on
Great question. Circumcision was related to penile dimensions and was one of the, I believe it was the only sociodemographic characteristic that I can think of offhand that was. Men who were not circumcised had larger penile dimensions.
What about the correlation with sexual satisfaction?
And circumcision? I don't remember for certain offhand. But these are all, feel free to email me. I'm happy to look at these things for you once I have the data set with me, or I'm sure Michael Reese would be more than happy to address these questions as well. So there is, I mean, that's a good question. So there, this data has been published in relative to other outcomes, so condoms, slippage, and breakage. There was one paper on that with this data set, so some of these things are in that paper. However, the things that I'm talking about today are new analyses from that data set, but those most certainly are papers that we're working on and we hope to have out relatively soon.
So a round of applause for the penile dimension.
Sorry, I know a little less about penises. However, I'll do my best now to transition on over to Debbie's talk and talk a little bit about, this was her dissertation work. So I wasn't around at that time, so it's going to be a little bit tricky for me to talk about the beginning stages of her research. However, those can be found in a paper. What she did is she designed a measure called the female genital self-image scale. And what it does is it's a better measure of women's genital perceptions than the measures that currently exist. As you can imagine, there aren't a ton of measures out there. The ones that did exist, she was disappointed in because she found them to be either double-barreled. So, you know, there were two meanings within the individual item, so it was really kind of tricky to tease apart what people actually meant when they responded to the questions. She also felt that it was problematic in that it included a midpoint in the scale, and because people may not have a concrete sense of their genitals or their perceptions around the genitals, she wanted to force people to choose one of the options and not just kind of get out of it and just go, you know, neutral. So she devised this new scale after, you know, a great deal of work, you know, working with undergraduate students and interviewing people and really kind of defining and redefining again this really wonderful measure on women's genital perceptions. The measure, I believe, is 7 items. You can find it in the paper. It's by Debbie Herbenick. It has the title Female Genital Self-Image in it. I'm sorry if I just found out that they weren't going to be here, else I would have prepared a little more in terms of what I was going to talk to. I'm just kind of informally discussing it with you today. But the second part of that I was involved in a bit more. So we recently conducted a national study of sex in America, which you may or may not have heard about. Prior to that, maybe a year before that, there was a national study on vibrator use, which also got a good amount of media attention. Within that data set, so this is nationally representative, women were, her female genital self-image measure was in that data set, so we have national rates on women's genital perceptions. With that measure, we wanted to validate it with a national population. So I conducted a confirmatory factor analysis and identified that actually a four-item scale was a more parsimonious measure than the seven-item scale. So, you know, four items, really easy for any of the providers out there who want to kind of assess these constructs to kind of just slip in there. And I believe there were global things. There was a satisfaction with kind of appearance. There were so four different items which kind of assess different components of women's genital perceptions. That item was related to women's FSFI scores, so their sexual functioning. All right. Any questions about Debbie's work?
Did you say where the scale is available at?
Mm-hmm. So the revised scale is actually should be in, I believe it's out in this month's issue of JSM, so Journal of Sexual Medicine. And you can look for Debbie or myself or...
Also on your center website, you have a nice list of the publications and sometimes links to the PDFs themselves.
That's right? Perfect. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, so there is, we try to update it as often as we can, and it should be relatively all updated right now. So if you go to the center's website, at Center for Sexual Health Promotion, Indiana University, a lot of that will be listed there. If the paper's not there, if you can't find it, feel free to email me, email the center. We're more than happy to send them to you, particularly in light of the fact that you know, you came here wanting to learn something, and I'm sorry that I can't give you everything that maybe you were hoping to learn. But I will give you a lot about vulvas, so you can look forward to that, and some pictures, so it's going to be a nice morning.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there any chance these two missing papers can be added to the APHA record belatedly, so that at least some outline, or I don't know if the abstract is on there, but
I certainly have the abstract. I will pass that request along to Debbie and Michael. Michael, I made that presentation with him, so I have access to it somewhere. I don't have access to it.
Be able to splice in a recording of their voices presenting something late.
I'll certainly, yeah.
It's worth a try.
I'll pass along the request. I'm sure that they'll be excited to hear that people were so excited about their work and about learning more about genitals. I mean, to be honest, it's 8:30 session last day. I'm really wonderfully surprised to see all of these faces out there.
Any other quick questions about female genital self-image? Maybe a round of applause for Debbie.
Yay, Debbie. She really did good work. So, all right. Now I will try to be a little bit more articulate. So I've spent approximately the past 5 years investigating the construct of women's genital aesthetics. So when I tell people that, they give me a strange look, and they say, is that a thing? For some it is, for some it isn't. However, I'm going to do my best to try to convince you today that it certainly is for some women, and it has clear public health implications, all right? So I'm gonna try to convince you, A, it's a construct, and B, it's a construct we need to pay attention to, and then C, because I have a little extra time, I'm also gonna tell you kind of how perhaps we can modify women's genital perceptions and make them feel better about their bodies. So I was going to piggyback off of some of the stuff that Debbie was going to talk about, but she was going to talk about global genital perception. I was going to try to convince you that women's specific genital concerns were more important, but I'll just kind of go into what I was going to talk about today. So as we all know, women's body perceptions play a really integral role in their sexual well-being. So we all know that there's numerous studies looking at the relationship between women's, whether it's their body size or their global body satisfaction, or whether it's their body size relative to what they want their body size to look like. There's many different measures of body size out there, and many of them are related to how women think or feel or act sexually. However, these measures aren't consistent in predicting sexual outcomes. In fact, there are some inconsistencies in these findings. And as we know with all research, when there's inconsistencies in findings, it can be due to a lot of things. We know that it can be because there's a different sample. We can know that it may be a different time. It may be the outcome was measured differently. But within the body image literature, because there are so many different body image measurements, oftentimes those inconsistencies are due to differences in the measurement of body perceptions. And the way that you measure someone's perceptions of their body really matters. I mean, if you think about kind of your global body perception as opposed to your size, those are two really different things. And part of the reason why those are different is because size is measuring one specific component about how you feel about your body, where global satisfaction may be measuring something much different. It may be measuring kind of an overall sense of how satisfied you are about yourself. Now, although that may be a good measurement, it may be a bad measurement, it's hard to say. It's a tricky measurement because we were talking about before about kind of unpacking some of these things, right? About unpacking these ideas of, so what is satisfaction? So oftentimes if you look at some of the scales, you'll be provided with women with different body sizes, and you'll be asked to pick the best body size, the body size you'd like to be. That's fine, but it only measures one thing. It doesn't maybe measure breast size. So a woman can be larger and maybe not feel great about her waist or her buttocks, but maybe she feels really great about her breasts, right? So she feels really good about them, but not so good about other parts. And it's not necessarily like a mean of how you feel about those parts, right? Because they may be salient at different times based upon different activities. And those body parts that are more or less salient they could be things that are obscure as perhaps your hands. So when you go to shake someone's hand, for instance, all of a sudden, at least I do, and maybe I'm more self-conscious than others, but as soon as I go to shake somebody's hands, I start to think about, my nails, and are they jagged? My skin, and have I put on lotion lately? Is my skin really dry? Like, how sweaty are my palms? Things that I wouldn't normally maybe think about, particularly if my hands are in my pockets, right? Those aren't kind of constructs that I'm regularly considering. But because I'm shaking somebody's hand, it becomes increasingly relevant. So in the same way that hands may be more or less relevant when they're out there, when somebody else is noticing them, or when they're in your pockets and nobody can see them, we can say the same thing about genitals, right? So most of the time, they're hidden. Nobody really sees them. Some people may have longer labia and may be walking around and may be a little bit uncomfortable, so maybe thinking about it all the time. But for most women, I imagine, it's not something that they're constantly thinking about. They're not constantly saying, oh, how does it look? Because people can't necessarily see it through your clothes. Kind of an obvious point, but an important one. However, when genitals do become relevant, when it is salient, are when women are engaging in sexual behaviors or seeking sexual care. So when somebody is looking at them or noticing them, all of a sudden, you're increasingly aware of them, right? Genitals are really, they're what are both eroticized, but they're also kind of, they're what we use for sexual activity. So it's interesting to think about, these are the components that are used, these are what gives us pleasure, this is what gives us pain, but yet we really know so little about what people feel about them. It's like there's this huge gap. So there is a limited amount of research on women's perceptions of their genitals, but it's really scarce. The literature that does exist out there, it's really very global. Now, Debbie's measure is global as well, but at least it assesses specific constructs within that global measurement. Most of the other research out there, it says things like, are you satisfied with your genitals? Well, I don't know. I may be satisfied with my clitoris, but I'm a little concerned about the smell. There's a lot of things going on, right, with genitals. And people can, with their bodies, can feel differently about different components. So oftentimes the research has focused on kind of really these global perceptions, or within the media, when you think about genitals and genital concerns, people come back to the ideas around either odor, most likely because there's a multi-million dollar industry that's kind of encouraging us to be concerned about the odors of our genitals. Or we're thinking about maybe pubic hair, again, something that we see talked about kind of on TV. So these are things that kind of have been out there in the media a little bit more. We know less about women's genital aesthetic concerns, so how people think about what about the appearance of their genitals. So when I first started this, people would say, that's not a thing. People don't think anything about the appearance of their genitals. And I would say, well, what about the rise in elective genital cosmetic surgeries? So for those of you who don't know what elective genital surgeries are, there's a range of different surgeries that one can get. They're not all for aesthetic reasons. Most of them are. The most common of which is labiaplasty. It shortens one or both of the labia in order to make them either shorter. Women do it to make them pinker, because oftentimes they'll have the darker edge taken off, or more symmetrical if women are concerned that one is longer than the other. So women report various reasons. We actually know very little about the women who seek these surgeries, something that I'm happy to talk to you about later. It's a study that my colleagues and I are conducting now. But we do know that they're happening, and we do know that they're on a rise, and we do know that they've been compared to where breast augmentation was about 20 years ago. So it's on the rise quick, there's different theories about kind of why this is happening and what should be done about it, if anything, or if it's a good thing, if it's a bad thing. Not going to talk too much about that today, but I do want to make you aware that this is something that's happening, and to say that genital aesthetic concerns is not a construct is problematic if women are actually seeking out surgery because it's such a concern. Right. So the limited research we have on these genital aesthetic concerns, which is a study that I did with some colleagues, assesses, again, these kind of global aesthetic concerns. So kind of the mean concern about your genital aesthetic, but not necessarily the individual components. So we don't necessarily know whether someone's perception of their clitoris will be a better predictor of one sexual behavior than their perceptions of their labia minora. Right. And I do have to warn you, sometimes people often refer to me as a labia minora researcher. So really, that's your career? Yes. So I do tend to be a little more focused on labia minora, but that's just because I think that it's one of the primary differences in women's genital appearances is really the length of the labia minora. Other things can vary as well. But for me, I tend to focus a little bit on the labia minora. So one of my biases, I don't have anything to disclose. However, I guess I did just disclose that. All right. So I meant for this to be somewhat of a conceptual talk. However, I'm a little bit unusual in that I'm a data person. So for me, a conceptual talk looks like a lot of data. So in order to prove my point, you know, I feel like I have to kind of go through and do it with numbers. So bear with me. There's going to be, you know, some, and I'll walk you through it. But I do mean for it to kind of have kind of an overarching message of understanding genital aesthetics. So there were several goals of the present study, or what I want to talk to you about today. The first is to assess the contribution of genital aesthetics in understanding and predicting the sexual health outcomes that we all care very much about in this room. The second of which is to investigate the role of women's perceptions regarding specific components of their genitals. So first, I want to try to convince you that genital aesthetics matter. And then I want to talk you through why measuring genital, different components of the genitals matters even more. So kind of unpacking that and looking at these really specific components. The sexual health outcomes that I'm going to look at today are both enjoyment, so it's kind of lifetime enjoyment overall, perceptions of enjoyment, and orgasm within the past 30 days from three female genital focused activities. So you'll see fellatio is not on there. Anything that has to do with the male genitals I didn't really include because, as I said before, women's genitals may not be as salient unless they're being looked at or touched. So I wanted to measure manual stimulation, on the woman, cunnilingus, and penile-vaginal intercourse. In addition to that, so there's sexual behavior. That's one time when your genitals are kind of out there and they're kind of a part of your sexual world. The other time when they're on display is when you're at the gynecologist, right? So one, they're on display to your partner or partners or whoever you're displaying them to. And then at the other time, it's your healthcare provider, right? So these are both different, for us, meaningful in terms of sexual health. We want people to have, you know, enjoyable, pleasurable experiences. But we also want people to seek out healthcare when it's needed and to follow recommended guidelines. So two hypotheses, the first of which, appearance-based concerns will predict sexual health outcomes beyond these kind of existing genital constructs, so these really global measures or things like odor that I talked about before that are frequently thought of as the best predictors of some of these sexual health outcomes. And again, these outcomes will be differentially predicted by these various genital components based upon what the outcome is. So really trying to be specific. So thinking about, if you're measuring intent for a behavior, you want to be really specific in your attitude. I'm saying the same thing here. If we want to measure a specific outcome, we have to be really specific in our genital measure. So I'm going to kind of talk you through that today. So the methods for the study included 485 undergraduate women. They were undergraduate women. Part of the reason for that was A, because it's an easy population to access, but B, these women are probably, they're in an earlier stage, they're 18 to 24, and they're just kind of defining and understanding and learning about their genitals. Under 18, there's other IRB issues, clearly, that one has to go through. So they're just learning about their genitals. So it's important in that regard. But it's also important in terms of their gynecological care. Gynecological care is recommended for women in this age group. However, many women are not seeking gynecological care at this age. So if there's one point to kind of intervene or one age group that one should focus on, it may be this young group of women. So although they are, undergraduate women, there is a rationale behind that. The procedure, simple. It was an anonymous web-based survey. They were provided with the link, and they went through the survey at a computer of their choosing. So it was anonymous. The questions that they asked could be in their own home, which we felt was important considering the personal nature of some of these questions. The genital measures, there are many in the study, but I'm going to talk about two today. The first is the genital self-image scale. So this is different from Debbie's scale, which I talked about before. It's a scale by Berman and Windeker from 2008. There's two parts of the scale, the first part of which are items where people agree to strongly disagree with various components. I didn't use that part. What I used were these unipolar scales that were basically just adjectives, and people indicated how much they agreed with each of these constructs or how much it related to them. And I'll go into each one of those individual adjectives in just a second, so remember this, I'm coming back to it. The second scale, in order to assess genital appearance satisfaction or dissatisfaction, I go back and forth on how I talk about it, was the vulva appearance satisfaction scale, which is based off of the body satisfaction scale, which basically asks women to assess different components of their body and how satisfied they are with those components. In terms of the outcomes, the sexual outcomes I said before was frequency of orgasm, which was dichotomized, so it was whether or not women had an orgasm from that specific behavior within the past 30 days, and their enjoyment of those behaviors. So enjoyment and orgasm can obviously be very different things, so I felt that it was important to include those both when talking to you today. In terms of gynecological care, I both assessed their history, so have they ever had a gynecological exam? Also, their anxiety, the perceptions of the exam as potentially or has been anxiety-provoking or embarrassing, and their intentions to avoid the procedure because of that anxiety or that embarrassment. So this is the genital self-image scale, the second half that I mentioned earlier. These are the various adjectives that women were provided with and asked to rate the degree to which they endorsed it for themselves. Four was strongly or frequently, one was not at all. So we can see overall, very promising, women had relatively positive perceptions of their genitals. Right. Most women feel relatively okay. However, we do see that in terms of, again, my talk is about genital aesthetics and attractiveness. So when looking at the different adjectives that represent attractiveness or unattractiveness, we see that they're relatively low compared to the other adjectives. So attractive is actually the lowest mean of the scores, and the same with, you know, unattractive is slightly higher on the negative scale. Sorry to do a double negative on you there, but hopefully you can think through that. So basically what I want you to take away from this, women are relatively positive about their genitals, but aesthetics is clearly a component or a concern relative to the other concerns that they may have. So to the good stuff. The relationship of these different genital components to sexual enjoyment and orgasm. So what I did at the first step, so there are several different things that I did for each one of these outcomes. The first thing that I did was a stepwise forward logistic regression in order to assess which individual constructs were the best predictors of these outcomes, and which variables did not predict a significant amount of variance over and above the variables that did. So basically, I wanted to know which ones were the best predictors, and once you already had those in the model, which ones were no longer predictive anymore. So I did this first with enjoyment of manual stimulation, and what I found was that the women's perceptions of their genitals as unattractive and desirable were the only two components that predicted whether or not they, I don't know why I did that, enjoyed manual stimulation. Okay. I also had an open-ended item at the end of each response. So women were asked whether or not they enjoyed the behavior, and then they were asked why they did or why they didn't. So I'm going to provide a few examples here where women talk about their genitals in relationship to why they do or do not enjoy these activities. They were not asked specifically about these genitals, so these were just spontaneously given responses to kind of, which will help us think about, and it really speaks to the importance of genitals within these activities. So one woman says here, when asked about the enjoyment of manual stimulation, she says, "Feels good. Makes me feel that they are not repulsed by my genitals. Make me feel liked." Right. So by somebody providing her with manual stimulation, she feels like perhaps they like her genitals more. Next, I looked at cunnilingus. Clearly something that may be related to the genitals, considering how kind of up close and personal people are during the time of cunnilingus, you know. So I predicted that, you know, there would be a host of different variables that would predict this outcome. In fact, what I found was that enjoyment of cunnilingus was predicted only by women's perceptions that their genitals were unattractive or well-shaped. What does that mean? We'll try to figure out in a second. An orgasm predicted only by women's perceptions that their genitals were good-sized. Sorry, that isn't well-sized. That's not me. That was the measure. So really, I expected, you know, malodorous to be a concern, people concerned that they're embarrassing or inadequate or several of these other components. But in actuality, when we put it into the model, what came out was really these appearance-based concerns, which is surprising given the emphasis that we've really spent looking at these other components, these really general global perceptions or these perceptions of the genitals as like odorous or pubic hair or other things. So again, kind of these open-ended responses about enjoyment of cunnilingus. So women said several different things. Again, it's hard to orgasm and I feel awkward about how I look and taste. I felt self-conscious about the appearance and odor. I'm embarrassed about the appearance and odor of my vagina. And the last one, which love it. Despite my self-consciousness of beef curtains, which is a reference to the labia minora, which may be longer, or large inner labia, it's worth it to get over my shyness and enjoy it for what it is. So she finds it to be a very pleasurable activity, but she's very aware of her genitals during it and has to kind of work through that. So when looking at individual components of the genitals, so again, trying to tease that apart, what is well-shaped? What is good-sized? Is it that your clitoris is a good size? Is it that maybe you have a large clitoris, so you're enjoying it more? Or is that you're concerned that you have a large clitoris and it doesn't appear the way that you'd perhaps like? So those are things that we really need to look at specifically. So when looking at those individual components, so satisfaction with your clitoris, labia majora, labia minora, pubic hair, vaginal canal, we found that predictors of whether or not people enjoyed cunnilingus were whether or not they were satisfied with the appearance of their labia majora and satisfied with the appearance of their labia minora. Orgasm from cunnilingus was predicted by their labia majora, labia minora, and vaginal canal. So last sexual health, sexual behavior was vaginal intercourse. And again, we expected this to be a little bit different. So somebody's, you know, your genitals are clearly involved. They're part of that story. But, you know, they're not necessarily as up close and personal with a partner in the same way, and that somebody's not necessarily looking at them or evaluating them directly. So I predicted that maybe there would be different components that would predict enjoyment and orgasm. And here, I found that enjoyment was predicted by whether or not people felt their genitals were desirable. And orgasm was predicted by whether they felt, again, the idea of them being well-shaped or healthy. All right. And I think that these next few open-ended items really speak to the fact that these different components, the health of their genitals, is what's best predictive of penile-vaginal intercourse. Enjoyment and orgasm. So the first of which is, I'm still experiencing an extreme amount of pain. I'm visiting the gyno next month to discuss it. So a health-related issue related to the genitals, not necessarily a concern when we saw about cunnilingus, about kind of the smell or the appearance. I lost my virginity a year ago, and I've only had sex like six times, and it still hurts a lot. I don't have STDs or abnormalities, though. So again, trying to think about the genitals as healthy, even though they're painful. And the last one, makes me feel good, but I don't have sexual intercourse due to discomfort caused by recurrent yeast infections. So again, kind of a health-based concern. When looking at the individual components of the vulva that predicted these outcomes, we see that labia majora and the vaginal canal, so satisfaction with those components, predicted enjoyment. And labia majora and vaginal canal predicted orgasm. So when the partner is a little bit further away, and when the vaginal canal is maybe a little bit more relevant during penile-vaginal intercourse, those are things that people are increasingly aware of. So finally, just talk about gynecological care. And my talk is a little bit longer, but because I had three presentations that I could talk through. So gynecological care, so again, we assess this because women may be concerned about their genital appearance. When seeing the gynecologist, they may be concerned about what the gynecologist is seeing. Does it look normal? Is everything okay? So when assessing whether or not women had anxiety and embarrassment about the exam and whether they would be less likely to seek the exam because of these feelings, we found that the best predictors of that outcome included, again, this idea of them being well-shaped and, to my surprise, desirable, which is not something I thought, it was something that I thought would come up more in the sexual behaviors and less at the gynecologist. So it's kind of interesting to think about what desire really means or desirable really means and why that would be related to gynecological care. Here we see that the component of the genitals that were related to embarrassment and anxiety included the clitoris, which speaks to the idea of them being like desirable, right? I oftentimes associate the clitoris with desire, but it doesn't. It does help me understand why that's a predictor of gynecological care and not maybe cunnilingus. Whether or not women had visited a gynecologist in the past, and there were quite a few women who had not, the predictor was whether or not women found their genitals to be attractive. So it's also interesting to see there's unattractive and attractive in here, right? So at some point somebody said, well, what's the difference? Well, the difference is, you know, unattractive is I'm dissatisfied with my genitals and that's keeping me from doing X or doing Y or making me do Y. Attractive is saying I'm satisfied with my genitals, so that's going to help me do X or Y. So there's something really different between body dissatisfaction and body satisfaction. Just something to think about. So here we have mean attractiveness rates based upon whether or not people visited the gynecologist. And as you can see, people felt that their people who had never visited the gynecologist felt that their genitals were less attractive. Now, this is a correlational study, so this could either go either direction in terms of the cause. So it's possible that women are concerned that their genitals aren't attractive, so they're not going to the gynecologist, right? But then there's the other possibility that maybe women are having really great experiences at the gynecologist. And so, you know, they feel really great about the way their genitals look when they leave. So then maybe those, maybe it's the experience of visiting the gynecologist that's making them think that their genitals are more attractive. And with this data, we can't tease that apart. So again, those individual components that predicted whether or not someone visited the gynecologist, and all of the components did. So the idea of my genitals are attractive was really kind of a conglomerate of all of these different components. Okay. So to just, and so when we ask people about their gynecological care intentions, again, people focused on kind of their fear, maybe their genitals. Despite some discomfort with my genitals, sexual health is very important to me. So as we saw earlier, you know, with cunnilingus, you know, it's really pleasurable. So I kind of have to get over my discomfort. The second woman said, I've never been for a pap smear, but just the thought of it makes me feel uneasy. So just the amount of anxiety that a lot of women can feel around the exam. So to sum up kind of the first half, we saw that really a lot of the concerns that women had or the best predictors of these sexual health outcomes when it comes to genitals aren't the things that perhaps that we were told in the literature that they would be or within the popular media that they would be. So it wasn't things like odor. Odor didn't come up once. It wasn't really these kind of global ideas around, you know, function. There were these really specific aesthetic concerns primarily that predicted these outcomes. When looking at the specific genital components, again, it's not just people's concerns about their labia minora, although I suspected that it would be considering I'm a labia minora researcher. It was really the concerns that women had about the various components of their genitals really was related to the act that they were engaging in or not engaging in. So again, going back to the idea of penile-vaginal intercourse, it makes sense that the vaginal canal would be, you know, would be a better predictor there than it would during some other behaviors. So quickly, I just want to talk about so kind of the problem, general aesthetics are concerned. Overall, women feel okay about their genitals, but those who don't may not be enjoying certain sexual behaviors as much and may not be, may either be really anxious about seeing the gynecologist or they may not be doing it at all. So kind of part two, here's my kind of quick and dirty solution. So what do we do about this? How do we make women feel better about their bodies? So in order to kind of understand how to kind of fix the outcome, we need to take a few steps back and understand how people come to feel badly about their genitals. A study that I did maybe a year or two ago with some colleagues, which I titled Evolvolution. It's really, I love puns, and that one was my favorite. Looked at the representation of women's genitals in a mainstream magazine from the 1950s, so the very first centerfold ever within that men's magazine, to the most recent centerfold. So we looked at every single centerfold and looked at changes in people in the depictions of vulvas over time. You may not be surprised to find out that pubic hair pretty much disappeared. I don't know. If you've picked up a magazine recently, you're probably not going to see a lot of it. And as pubic hair disappeared, so it started to disappear maybe in the 80s, as it disappeared, we saw a little bit of labia minora. At that time, I don't know whether there weren't perceptions around labia minora or there weren't concerns or whatever it was. We saw a little bit of labia minora in the 80s, the time of the labia. And then all of a sudden, pubic hair disappears entirely, more or less. We've got a little landing strip here and there, but that's about it. And we also see with it, labia minora vanishes, right? All of a sudden, it's really, and I'll show you a picture later, it's a line. So it looks kind of similar to a prepubescent girl's genitalia. We also went back through the most recent years magazines and found that that wasn't just a function of the centerfolds, that was actually something that existed throughout the magazine. So that's the representation that women are receiving or people are receiving when they're reading this mainstream, very popular men's magazine. Women subscribe to it as well. Okay, so this representation is constricted, right? We're really only given one image of what women's genitals look like. Given that women aren't necessarily, you know, walking around looking at each other's genitals, we may have to rely on these kind of non-social reference. So there's this representation. I propose that it would lead to an internalization, right? So we don't have a lot of social reference. We don't necessarily know what genitals, the normal range of genitals is or could be. Oftentimes we don't talk about it with our friends. It's not a discourse that's open and available. So we look to what's there, and if there's only kind of really one constrained image that's available to us, perhaps we're going to use that to evaluate the normality of our own genitalia. So these representations lead to this internalization of how you think or feel about your genitals. In turn, sorry, I like everything to rhyme, it leads to the manifestation of these different genital health outcomes, which I just talked to you about, which in turn may lead to surgical modification, which we talked about earlier, so the elective cosmetic surgeries. Now, the surgical modification may, you know, help the individual. However, that also has social implications in that if women hear that the surgery is available, there all of a sudden becomes kind of this ideal genital that you should have. And then if they see the pre and post pictures, so there's pre, and if, God forbid, that's what you actually look like, then you realize that, no, the post is what it should be, right? So you're all of a sudden, these ideas around what genitals should and shouldn't be are constructed based upon even just these websites of these surgeries. Okay. So what do we do? Well, a lot of feminist researchers and other people question the surgical modification, and they say, let's take it out of the model. That's what's causing the problem. Let's get it out of there. I personally believe that there are individual benefits, and a lot of women do seek these surgeries for reasons that we may not be aware of. So instead of maybe just taking that option away from women, which, to be honest, we can't do anyways, let's provide them with images of vulva diversity. Okay. So this is what I tried to do in an experiment to follow up the last study that I discussed. So again, a web-based survey, female undergraduate students, there are 185 within this study. They're randomly assigned to one of several different conditions, the first of which was the men's magazine. So this is the image that I was talking about before, kind of the prepubescent genitalia. There's really just kind of like this one, it's really just a line. I was calling it a labia line for a while. So images, they were exposed to six different images from men's magazines that looked almost exactly like this. They were exposed to women's genital images post-labiaplasty or pre-labiaplasty, and these were matched so that it was the exact same woman. So that way I could control for things like race or other components of the genitals if it's the exact same woman. And then a control condition where women didn't receive any of these pictures. Right? So they saw women, it was a between subjects design, they saw six different images of women's genitals and were asked to evaluate them. Overall, we saw that women rated the pre-labiaplasty, so kind of this more realistic image of what genitals may look like. They rated them as the least ideal, the least attractive. Okay. I presented this data in many different ways. This is the first time I'm actually presenting it like just like this, so I'll talk you through it. So women were asked about their size of the various components of their genitals, with the exception of pubic hair. That wasn't size, that was amount. Obviously, size of your pubic hair can be a really confusing construct for people. So they were asked about amount of pubic hair. Now, within their size perceptions, we see that their size does vary based upon their exposure to these genital images. Now, it doesn't vary in the kind of clean, systematic way I was hoping it would. It is a little bit messy. I was particularly perplexed by these control people who really had these varied genital perceptions based upon the people who saw the genital images. So they felt their labia minora was very large, and they had never... they had not seen any of these pictures. So, as one example, within this, there were significant differences in relative to women who saw the pre-labiaplasty picture. So, using that as our referent group, so pre-labiaplasty, these realistic images, women significantly differed in their perceptions of the size of their clitoris and the size of their labia minora. Again, but not clean and not the way that perhaps I hoped the data would look. But does the data ever really look exactly the way that we hope it will look? I don't know. Okay. So, oh. I don't know where the satisfaction one went. The satisfaction scale looked very similar. There was a significant difference with women's perceptions of their satisfaction with their clitoris and their labia minora if they received these realistic images relative to these constrained images, or the ones from the sexually explicit men's magazine, or the pre-labiaplasty pictures. So just exposing women to these six images significantly predicted the way they thought the size of their genitals, so thinking about that as a really malleable construct, and also their satisfaction with their genitals. Okay. So conclusions, I'm almost done. These appearance-based concerns are consistent predictors of these different sexual health outcomes. In fact, they're even better predictors than I had originally thought they would be. I thought perhaps they'd predict above and beyond some of the other things, but in fact, they were the sole predictors. The individual components of the vulva uniquely predicted these different sexual health outcomes. So it wasn't that women just said, oh, I don't know, my perceptions of my vaginal canal are what predicts all of these sexual behaviors. No, women are really aware of the different components of their vulva. Oftentimes people say to me, well, women don't know what anything about their labia minora versus their labia majora. And I say, no, they do, and they may think about them differently. Right. Women were provided with a diagram, though. So I'm sorry, I forgot to mention that earlier. All right, so there were parts that were labeled. And finally, from the experiment, we can see that general perceptions may be very malleable, considering that, and modifiable, considering that this was just exposure to 6 pictures, and following that, women's genital perceptions had already changed. So that really speaks to the limited imagery that's available out there, and how important it is to have appropriate imagery available to women. There were clearly limitations on the data that I collected. You know, it's a very homogenous group. You know, there was a reason for that. However, it does just represent young women. It doesn't represent all women. There are different genital perceptions in different cultures. That's something that I'm starting to investigate now. I do have a global study where we're looking at genital perceptions. From this data set, we can only make conclusions about these young women from this one place. The measures were specific, but they weren't specific enough, right? So we asked about satisfaction with the appearance of their labia minora. What does that mean, right? Is it satisfaction with the symmetry? Is it satisfaction with the length? Is it satisfaction with the color? Is it satisfaction with the texture? What is that mean? So we need to continue to unpack that and understand that. And again, that's something that I am currently investigating as well. I have a measure that looks at that in much greater detail. I both have one for women and one for men. And that doesn't just make assumptions about larger is better or smaller is better. Kind of the midpoint is, you know, this is the way I'd like it. And there's maybe a 9-point scale that said, I'd like it to be larger, or I'd like it to be smaller. So I'm continuing to kind of unpack and understand these constructs. This is kind of just the beginning for me, although it is 5 years in. So the refinement of the experiment as well, you know, it did predict these outcomes, but not in like a consistent, clean way. I did replicate it again in a different way, didn't work. I have some ideas about how it needs to be re-replicated. I think that the vulva needs to be attached back to women's bodies. I know it seems like a novel idea, but in order for women to kind of assess the vulva in relation to the situation or the context. I mean, taking the vulva out of the context may vary how women think or feel about it. And finally, this was not dyadic data, and it's quite possible that partners' perceptions of your genitals, so whether if your partner says, oh, they're beautiful, oh, I love them, or your partner says, oh, those are beef curtains, like the woman was concerned about earlier, may really predict how women think and feel about their genitals, right, as it does for men. And again, that's something that I am currently investigating as well. So more to come. For those in the public health audience, as you know, we all are, some questions I would like to pose to you is kind of who, what, where, when, why, how, kind of how do we distribute these normative images, if that is the answer. Clearly, we're not going to go into elementary schools with Familia or Petals, which are books of genital imagery, although it would be great, I think, if we did. There would clearly be some problems. So if that's not the answer for, and if we need to target younger women, how else can we try to increase genital self-esteem? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. You're okay taking your questions?
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. better than I'll be taking the other ones. So. It did. Yeah. No, it's a good point. And it speaks to the importance of qualitative research, which I don't have on this and is something that I do need to have. So within quantitative research, you know, it says, well, appearance is the number one concern and odor is number two. So it doesn't necessarily play into the model. But when you actually probably talk to women about it, maybe both of those things are there. And it may also be, I mean, we're told that odor's supposed to be a concern. So maybe it's something that, you know, I thought that it would be predictive, so maybe it's something that they felt like they should say is predictive as well. It's hard to know. Again, something that we need to continue to investigate. Yeah.
Thank you for the talk. Two quick questions. In terms of the referent for dissatisfaction, the images that you showed versus inherent dissatisfaction, so recognizing something may not be right about my body, or comparing to another, can you comment a little bit on that? Because the referent coming from a men's magazine, which of course women do access, it's geared towards men. The second question that goes along with that is, did you assess the sexual orientation of these women? And thirdly, maternity status, because postpartum, labia typically change in color, hormonal changes, so on and so forth. So.
Three great questions. You may have to remind me of all three as I start to go through. Okay, so as the referent, people often ask about why, you know, I just looked at a men's magazine and how we can make that leap about this being representative of all images of women's genitals. We can. This is one source. It happened to be my first vulva image, so I guess that's kind of why I started there. But, you know, I think that women do pick them up. From the table, what have you. It is recognized as maybe more of, because it's a well-known name, it may also, women may understand that that's really an ideal. So something that I struggle with in my research and I continue to kind of refine and think about is whether women are, whether these are norms or are ideals that are being constructed. So, which is something with, you know, with your body, you can kind of, we know that there's ideals for the body, but we kind of also know that there's a normative range. But with genitals, I'm not really sure whether women are concerned about the genital appearance because they don't think it's normal or because they don't think it's ideal. So within the sexually explicit men's magazine, it may just be constructing ideals and not necessarily norms because women do have access to other pictures of genitals on the internet. I am conducting or have in the past been looking at Google and Google Images and what women get when they type in certain descriptors. And what I found is overwhelmingly there's a lot of these genital reconstructive surgery websites, which is why I had those images in as well. And that really constructs the idea of, oh my gosh, there's this problem and here's this solution. And this is the wrong look and this is the right look. The second question was sexual orientation, and the third was women who have, so these were, so sexual orientation, very homogenous sample. The global study that I was talking about earlier is of women who have sex with women. So those, I very detailed assessments of what women think about their genitals and what they think and hope for about their partner's genitals. I analyzed that data yet. We haven't taken it. We haven't stopped collecting. We're currently collecting it. However, I can't help but continually read the qualitative responses because they're fascinating. And so far, it appears as though, kind of just preliminary thoughts, women are saying a lot of the same things that we would imagine that their male sexual partners would say. So they're saying things like, I would like them to have smaller labia, which was really shocking to me. So look for that because it'll hopefully be out at some point soon. And the third of which is looking at women's perceptions of their genitals after they've had a child. Again, young women, so not in this study, but another study that we are conducting and we the data is almost fully collected and we're looking at women's perceptions of their genitals after they've, within the first year of pregnancy. So a lot of genital stuff happening in my world, which makes it a good one. Yeah.
Thank you so much. This has been really fascinating. I'm wondering if in this study that you did or in future studies, you have considered measuring what women's genital hygiene practices and like pubic hair grooming practices are to see if perhaps what they're doing is predictive of what their levels of satisfaction are.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps you don't see, you know, bad odor as a predictor of things because people are douching or they are using like any of these products in the huge vaginal good smelling industry.
No, it's a great point, and we recently had a paper in Journal of Sexual Medicine on women's pubic hair practices, so we do have some data on that. Within that data set, we also have daily diary data, so women's pubic hair shaving patterns or removal patterns are going to differ every day, right? So there's some women who may just shave and be shaved, and that may be the end of the story. But most women aren't doing it every day. So on one day, you may be someone who removes your pubic hair. On the next day, you may be somebody who has pubic hair mostly grown in, right? So it's really important to assess that on a day-to-day level and looking at particularly sexual outcomes on an event level, which is something that we're looking at, and the same with female hygienic products in relationship to other constructs as well.
Excellent presentation. I'm wondering, just comment and a question, and also kind of in reference to what the guy was just talking about. Have you done any research looking at the health books that young girls use and do? While I know in this particular study you use men's health, I know for most of us growing up, our health books had normal images of what a breast should look like, normal images of what your vagina should look like. What a normal period should be, but majority of us, you know, we are fall well out of that 28-day period cycle and all that. And I'm thinking about our conference today. I stopped by the Office of Women's Health desk, and they had those same images that this Men's Health magazine had when it came to the guidebook that they were giving out for teen girls. So I'm wondering, are you considering doing research to actually look into our, or maybe even to approach the Office of Women's Health and say, hey, you need to be showing other different images, because I actually think when it comes to this generation, yes, they're getting it from the internet, but they're also getting it from what we as public health officials are showing.
I think that is such a wonderful, wonderful point. And something that definitely taking this to kind of a place of policy or kind of thinking bigger and outside on the implications is something that I should be doing. I really thank you for that comment. In terms of the resources that the health books that young women receive, there I haven't done any research on it, but there is some research out there which suggests that the images that are available in books are really images of genitals with STIs, or that, you know, there's concerns. This is what it shouldn't look like. There's really no images of, like, this is what it should look like, and that's okay, and this is good, and this is normal. And that's a concern with a lot of different body parts, and maybe the penis as well, but it's been something that researchers have focused on specifically with the vulva. Our bodies ourselves has one picture of women's genitals, but it's really dark. And there's, you know, it's a lot of pubic hair, so it's really hard to see. And there's only one picture, right? So even if that picture has larger labia, it's still just one picture. There's a wide range of what women need to see. I think that that's a really wonderful point. And it should, yeah, we should kind of look at and try to get them into young women's health books. Yeah.
So I have lots of questions. I'll just speak to a couple of them. First of all, has there been any studies done looking at like satisfaction with their genitalia of men versus women? First of all, first question. Second question is, as a clinician, my natural thoughts are, after seeing your information, is that these problems that women have or encounter or are dissatisfied with, how likely are they to discuss that with their primary care provider or OBGYN? And have any studies looking at how likely they are and how we can improve their chances of discussing that with us?
Both really wonderful questions. There has been, there's one study that I'm aware of that looks at men's and women's perceptions of their own genitals and of other men's and women's genitals. That study that found that overall men were just felt more positively about genitals, so both about their own and about women's genitals. We are also, when I said that we're doing, we're looking at dyadic data, it's couple data, so I'm having participants rate both their own and their partner's genitals, and I expect to find that people will be more positive about their partner's genitals than they'll feel about their own genitals. So there is some research that suggests that maybe men do feel, you know, better about their genitals than women do.
Let's say they go by that I don't get an email about, you know, penis enlargement and all that kind of stuff, and you see it all the time, even on TV, and they even have shows about it. Like, you never see anything about any kind of surgical manipulation or anything like that for women. Should that be a possible option? You know what I'm saying? I never have ever.
Yeah, you're not bombarded with the messages as much. But I don't know that that makes it better. It just really, that may just close up the discourse, you know, like it may be, I have this concern, but nobody else is talking about it. I must be a real freak, you know? So I don't know that it necessarily, at least with like the, oh, there's that spam message again about penile enlargements. That's ridiculous, isn't it? You know, at least it gets people talking. With women's genitals, it's so scary to talk about, right? It's scary to talk about that they look different. It's scary to talk about, even with your friends, that yours might look different than other people's. So I think that not having that out there is almost more problematic than maybe having something to open up that conversation. In terms of gynecological care and seeking and kind of what the provider can do to reassure women, we do know that some women are talking to their gynecologists about it because oftentimes it's either the gynecologists who are referring these women or the gynecologists themselves who are giving these women labiaplasty. So unless the gynecologist is bringing up that concern with the women, which I'm hoping is not the case, women are voicing concerns about the appearance of their genitals to their gynecologist. So then what does the gynecologist do? Really becomes the question. There's only one study that I'm aware of that looked at kind of what a gynecologist says or does in relationship to people's concerns about the appearance of their genitals. And in it, they asked people whether their gynecologist said that their genitals were, I'm trying to think of the exact wording because it was unusual, something like, it wasn't maybe attractive, but it wasn't sexy, it was something in between that would seem really unusual for your gynecologist to say to you. People don't really want to be told that their genitals are like really, I mean, they want to know that they're normal and okay and function well, but you don't necessarily want your gynecologist to be evaluating your body in that kind of way, the same way you wouldn't want your gynecologist to maybe say like, wow, you've got great breasts or something. It feels a little uncomfortable. So women who did say that their gynecologist said that to them didn't have a more positive experience, but perhaps if there were better messages that gynecologists could say like, oh no, it's within the normal range, or you know, I don't know exactly what those messages would be, but framing them the correct way would be important. Nick Karas, who did the Petals book, I don't know whether you know about him. It's a book of different genital images, and one of the projects that he and his wife are currently working on are these posters that have different genital images, and says something lovely like, as different as a snowflake, and they're selling them to gynecologists' offices to actually have in the waiting room, just so people can kind of see and say, oh, okay, so you don't actually have to talk about it, you know, you can just kind of see and feel okay. That's a great question. Not that I'm aware of. The study that we did was mostly on just kind of pubic hair characteristics and who's doing what. But like I said, in the daily diary study, we want to look at the relationship of pubic hair to different sexual behaviors and different perceptions. In particular, we want to look at pubic hair in relationship to people's intentions to engage in sexual behavior later. So this idea of maybe getting like hookup ready, you know.
Sexfoliation.
Oh, nice, I like that. So yeah, no, there's a lot more that kind of needs to be investigated in relationship to pubic hair and how people think and feel about pubic hair. And I don't know how many of you in the room have taught a human sexuality class or have talked to students about pubic hair before, but oftentimes they appear frightened when they see pubic hair. It's really, and I think it's because of these images that we see in the media that are, you know, without pubic hair. So I think that there's this idea that you can't have pubic hair. So I don't know, I think that it really be, pubic hair in and of itself is really kind of like, is a packed concept, yeah, that we have to really try to get at further.
Yeah, I was just confused a little bit about some of your sexual health outcomes. Mm-hmm. The first was renal stimulation. Mm-hmm. I was kind of curious of one by whom. Is that self-stimulation, partner stimulation?
Great question. Partner. This was all partnered activity.
And that sort of links to my second question, which is, it looked like you studied exclusively penile and vaginal intercourse.
Mm-hmm. I did ask whether it was, I allowed them to say if whether, I didn't tease apart whether it was a penis or an object that was inserted into their vagina as intercourse. So that was allowed in the response. The sample was relatively homogeneous in terms of their orientation, but also their behaviors. So, I mean.
So they were able to specify, is what you're saying?
The item, the question allowed them to say. For either behavior, I categorize that as vaginal intercourse. So that's a good point. I should have called it vaginal intercourse and not penile vaginal. And it's definitely, these were just a few different behaviors that I started to look at. Clearly, the sexual repertoire of Americans is a lot more vast than what I looked at. I mean, masturbation is important, right? There's many different things that people do. And the way that they feel about those different behaviors may be uniquely predicted by these outcomes as well. This was kind of just kind of an overarching snapshot of some of these things. Yeah, no, I do need to be more specific. Yeah. The only study that I'm aware of is one that was really global. So it was just kind of like these general perceptions of how you feel about women's genitals. We don't necessarily know specifically how they think or feel about women's genitals. Like I said, that's something that we're looking into. And that's, yeah, I think that the one area that we're missing the most literature is on, yeah, men's perceptions of women's genitals and women's perceptions of men's genitals. So we know at least a little bit about what people think and feel about their own genitals, but less about what their partners think and feel. As a little anecdote, in addition to doing research on this topic, I like to think of myself as a genital activist. There's really a large group of us. And one of the things that I'm doing with my colleague, Debbie Herbenick, is we're putting together this blog, a video podcast on different genital-related topics. And for this one in particular, I dressed as a vulva, and I walked down the Las Vegas Strip, and Debbie asked people what, A, they thought I was, and A, how they felt about me, and how they, if they could tell women one thing. If it was a man, they asked the men, if they could tell women one thing about women's genitals, what would they tell them? And we were so encouraged. It was the response. We didn't know whether I was going to be in jail by the end of the night, but I wasn't, which was good. People were just really excited to kind of have this dialogue opened, but also partners, you could tell when they were together, the women would kind of listen in to see what their male partner thought about genitals, and the males were so they said the most beautiful things about accepting genital diversity, about loving vulvas. You know, clearly you weren't going to tell the giant vulva that you hated them. That could be pretty fierce, but, you know, they were really, really positive in a way that was completely unexpected by both Debbie and myself. One man kept just referring to me. We asked him what I was. He said, the best thing in the world, the best thing in the world. So, you know, an anecdote, but still makes me think that perhaps there are men who feel really positively about women's genitals.
My question comes from just if there is no previous literature, where do you think the source of, like, the standard comes from?
Of what genitals should be? I think that it's hard to say. So I think that it's kind of it's being constructed, right? And I think that it's a continual process. I don't think that there's... I think that the ideal has really, based upon my research of the content analysis, this ideal has kind of just recently creeped up. It wasn't really out there before a few years ago. And I think that there's kind of this, there's these kind of representations, right? And then women... And then from there, women start to feel badly about themselves, and then they get these surgeries, and then these surgeries are out there. So it's kind of creating this ideal. And I have thoughts about why that ideal is the ideal that it is, but I don't know how much we want to talk about social construction here.
And maybe time for one more question, and then those of you with continuing questions can come up afterwards. And
go ahead.
I want to make a general comment before we all disappear for today or for the year. I think this is a terrific beginning, and I congratulate you, Vanessa, for doing the work, and Jenny for bringing it to APHA, and I hope we all see this as just the beginning. And I also hope that because we've talked about domestic programs, you would use the word global, but I think really global. I work on international sexuality education, and the ramifications and importance of this research, this kind of research, are enormous for other cultures. Mm. I've been working in Africa. I think the effort to increase the availability of circumcision in Africa to prevent AIDS is tremendously important for millions of men. The whole issue of female genital mutilation, we haven't related to this.
There's certainly literature that does.
Of dry sex and other kinds of sexual relationships, which have enormous health implications, are so important. So we all need to really bring this to other cultures, and I hope it will be an annual, hopefully annual, effort at APHA. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Please join me in thanking you.